Okay, this is the review, lesson 4, Sefer Shofti, Sefer Shmuel. Too confused, I'm too hot.
Like your T-shirt?
Yeah, Sefer Shmuel, part 1 of the spring semester 2018. Mind boggles, 2018. Okay, and basically what we're going to do is two parts. This lesson number 1, a general intro, right, to exam questions and technique, etc. And then a discussion of the points on the review sheet as much as we can. Okay, if we don't get through the whole thing, then obviously if you're doing review and you're not quite sure what's going on, do not hesitate to email ripshaf@aol.com, and I will try and get back to you as soon as I can. Before we start the actual review, just want to say a couple of things, and those who heard this in the last lesson can have a little snooze while we're doing it. Close your eyes and sort of think of Florida, which is about the temperature that we're at the moment. Miami, actually, I should say more specific. The exam will run, I think it's 3 till 5, if I'm not mistaken, on the Tuesday. Not a happy time, a bit late, but whatever. Why they had to do 3 in one day, I really still haven't quite worked out, but the way that was decided. Have to speak to Dr. Katz. Any changes, any problems that you have exam-wise, you have to go through the administration, Dr. Katz. I can't, at this stage, really, at any stage, I can't really make those decisions. And the professors are not supposed to get involved with that. She coordinates everything. So if you're coming late, or you're missing the exam, or you're not well, or whatever, please make sure you get in touch with Dr. Katz. That's a general instruction. You're coming in, then obviously we'll see how that works out. I'm pretty sure that, you know, that with all the allowances, that will work itself out. Not worried about that, although it's 3 exams in one day. In terms of the questions, and again, I'm going to repeat what I said before, that you have 6 questions on the paper, do 5 out of 6. Please do not do 6 out of 6, because I will just put a red line or blue line or whatever pencil I have with me or pen, because I cannot look at 6 answers. I will only take the first 5, and you will have wasted your time. I want you to concentrate on 5 questions. In terms of the book that you can bring into the exam, the book that's acceptable is a straight translation. Okay, can be a JPS, can be a Koran. We have some.
You've been reading out of the paper?
No, that one is not acceptable because there's too much commentary in there. It's just one. Can't really have that book in the exam. But a straight translation of the Sefer is accepted, right? Straight translation. Hi there. Just got going.
What kind of books are
there? JPS, even the green art scroll. There's a green cover art scroll which is very straight translation, no commentary, very acceptable. Okay, not the art scroll with commentary. That's a different book. That's a blue cover book, and that's not acceptable. So basically, there's 2 books which are no good. They're good, but they're not good for the exam. One, which is the Judaica that we've been encouraging, and the other one is the art scroll with commentary. Anything else that is a straight translation, and obviously Mikraot Gedolot, if you can handle the Hebrew only, that is acceptable. If you have your own version of any of these books and you want to underline or highlight or whatever, please do so. I have no problem with that. Right? Because there will be certain psukim which will be much recommended for you to include in any answer. If you're talking about when you talk about Shaul, right? One of the expressions that it says about Shaul, Nechpa lekelim, okay, or Gam Shaul banaviim. All of those expressions about Shaul, which indicate a certain amount of question, right? Was Shaul the right guy? Nechpa bekelim, meaning he was hiding amongst the bags. He didn't want to be seen. Remember that whole story when they tried to find him, right, to anoint him. Shmuel wanted to announce that this is the new king. And he was hiding. He wanted to, as it were, have a low profile. Again, stuff like that, really important to have ready, so that if any question comes up about anything of that nature, you can refer to it, you can get the phrase. I'm not looking for chunks of sukkim. That's not what I want. Just the phrase. It can be in English. It doesn't have to be in Hebrew, but if you do it in Hebrew, that will also be good.
But you talk about the idea in English.
Sorry?
Talk about, like, the concepts.
And the concept would be fine as well. You know, as long as you make some sort of reference to the text. One of the things about the level that you're at in terms of study is that I would hope that you are now becoming sort of comfortable with the text. Not that I'm asking you to remember who said what about the text, right? I'm not looking for the Rashi said this and Ramban said that, because that comes at an MA level. That's a more serious level, and you know, you're expected to remember beforeshim at that level. But at this level, concepts. I want you to be absolutely comfortable with the text and the concepts around the text. Okay, so I want that to be understood. In terms of the booklets, I want to make it absolutely clear that on the cover of the booklet, didn't mention this in my last lesson, but I should have mentioned it, that please do not write anything on the blue cover. They're now, I think, blue. I'm pretty sure they're still the same booklets. Don't write anything on the cover except, obviously, your name, right? And if you're doing one or two booklets, booklet one, booklet two, but nothing on the actual inside cover or on the back cover. Okay, there was a young lady. I always talk about these students whose names have been long forgotten, but I'm sure she's still around in a very strong capacity somewhere in the world, who managed to write her whole answer to her last question on the inside blue cover. Amazing, at the back. Starting on the inside of the cover and finishing on the outside with about half a millimeter left. Amazing, amazing piece of work. Not necessarily something that made her very happy for me to look at, because I felt this was unnecessary, ridiculous actually. Why not use another book? But what I'm saying is, don't get to that stage. Make sure you use the books. And even if you have another one word or sentence to complete and you haven't got enough room in book number one, booklet number one, take, for goodness sake, booklet number two and use it. It's there to be used. Right? Don't worry about the rainforest. That's already, those booklets have been chopped down trees a long, long time ago, I can assure you. Not that I'm in favor of that, but it's just the way it is.
Will you be there for the final?
Sorry?
Will you be there?
Be'ezrat Hashem, God willing, all being one. So again, I must remind everybody, please do your evaluations online if you haven't done so already. Okay, and I just want to mention also that for those who are looking still for courses next semester, I'm offering a course on Megillot, which will be hopefully something extra you may not have seen, came onto the catalogue this week. It's going to be in the M section, which is 145 to 3 or whatever it is, 255. It's that section. So if you're looking for another course and you're suitably interested, then that course is available next semester. There's about 20 sign up at the moment. I'm not sure when the new students sign up. That's probably still to come. So it might get closed out. We'll have to wait and see. I hope not. Alright, so that's in terms of the book. Oh yes, Colors of Ink. I always again talk about a young lady, she remained nameless because I've forgotten her name, who wrote her answer in an amazing color. Right, my last lesson I suggested it was beige or some sort of color that you would probably feel comfortable with at a wedding, but not in the exam. Alright, please leave all your pinks and all your yellows and bright yellows, particularly at home. The color that you should write in should either be blue, traditional blue, or black, or pencil if you so incline. Get those regular pens and pencils and not anything more exotic. Okay, I do not want to have to sort of shine a beam on it in the middle of the night in the dark to be able to read your exam booklet, which has happened to me in the past, believe it or not. Quite incredible. Leave yourself plenty of time to finish the exam. That's another issue which I always stress. If you are planning to travel at the end of the exam, please don't make your travel plans to be like 30 minutes after the exam, because it just will compromise your effort in the exam. Again, third anecdote, which I always repeat, is this young lady who, again, remains nameless, forgotten who she is, but somewhere in the world today, who decided to fly to Israel at the end of my exam, but really was so unaware of what she'd booked. She actually was checking in at the moment when my exam was finishing, supposedly. So she had a check-in at 3 o'clock at JFK, and my exam finished at 3 o'clock. So obviously, when she got to the exam, she realized that she couldn't spend the required time. She had to get a cab. JFK is not around the corner. And she did the whole exam 20 minutes instead of an hour and a half, 2 hours, and compromised her grade. I think she would have got an A, ended up with a C. Very sad, but nothing I could do about it. So please don't do that. It's not a good idea. Okay, if you're traveling, give yourself plenty of time after the exam to recuperate and then run away into the fields or wherever you're going to go. Okay, north, south, east, or west, depending on your preference. Also, in terms of answering the questions, the order of the questions could be in any order. Okay, don't mind if you do sort of out of order. Don't have to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or whatever. And as I said before, please, no extra credit for 6 questions. That's not going to happen. You'll just be wasting your own time. Please write clearly each answer. Oh yes, very important. Each question has parts. So there'll be question 1, part A, part B and part C, or A and B. Sometimes it's 2 parts or 3. If, for instance, you want to write one whole answer for the 3 parts of the question, then you can do that, but make it absolutely clear to me that's what you're doing. Okay, I'm going to answer all 3 parts of the question, but I'm going to do it in one essay, as opposed to doing it in 3 separate paragraphs, which was the initial requirement. I don't have a problem with that, but you've got to make clear to me, absolutely clear, what you're doing. Okay? In terms of the sort of answers that is expected, I would say probably paragraphs as opposed to short answers. Okay, sort of each section of each question will deserve some sort of, maybe a short paragraph, some a bit longer. And I have no issue with you just doing one-sided answers, meaning not using the back page, just going through the booklets one side at a time, and then necessarily taking a second. And in some cases, some people even get to a third booklet. But please try and write clearly. No scrawls, as much as I know it's difficult and you're not usually used to writing by hand these days, but in this exam, it's a bit old-fashioned, but you know what? Not a bad thing. Because one day, if you haven't really had to do this, writing, the good old-fashioned way of writing pen and paper, may very well become something that you need to do. Okay? At least, you know, to write, if you're going to write a report, or whatever, in your work, you're going to initially have to write it out, pen and paper. Chief Rabbi Sachs this week extols the virtue in his Devar Torah of using a diary, pen and paper, not the thing that you have on your phone, which is all well and good, but doesn't really become more than an extension of all the other things that you have on your phone. A diary, the real thing, becomes a bit more serious, a bit more important. Read his Devar Torah if you don't usually read it. It's an interesting take on that particular concept. I think he's made a good point. Yes, question.
Every question has 3 points?
Usually 2 or 3.
2 or 3. Is there like a point that will be like how this connects today, or they're all like very detailed points?
They'll all be detailed, but again they may overlap, in which case you can, as I say, you can do it all as one answer. If it's 2 parts of the question and you can write the whole thing as one essay, tell me, I'm going to answer A and B in the following, and you know, and then go ahead and do it. Yeah, no problem. So I think that's important to understand. Anything else that you would want to know? Yes? Yeah, again, the questions could be in 2 or 3 parts. And all I would say to you is, if you want to answer A and B as one answer, just make it clear to me that's what you're doing. Because otherwise, if I see question 1, part A, and you're actually answering A and B, I will assume you've only answered part A, and you haven't answered B. So you've got 20 points for that question, you're getting 10 points for A, getting 0 for B. So if you make it clear to me, oh, I'm answering A and B, I don't have to deduce that, although I probably will anyway, right? But make it clear, then you'll get potentially 20 points, which is good for that, because that's a good point. Even 1980, whatever it is, it's good. It's kind of common sense, but I just want to make it absolutely clear, because I get these questions all the time. Any questions that you have, which you want to raise, please don't hesitate. Reb Shaff at AOL. And I will get back to you, Blee Nader, ideally within 24 hours. Ideally. It should be around, hopefully, during the next week or 10 days before the exam. Yes, please.
You don't need a seeker.
Well, again, that's what I said before you came in. I'm just going to repeat it again. Which is that, yes, it's very important to have a seifer, a translation, either a JPS or Koren, or, you know, Hebrew, English, or Mikroz Gedolah. What I can't allow you is a Tanakh with commentary. Meaning English commentary. So the English one that we've recommended, the Judaica, not acceptable, or the Art Scroll with commentary. Art Scroll do a one volume Tanakh, that's perfectly okay.
So it's time to have it with actual, like, the storyline.
Correct. No
not
problem with that. But not the commentary. And I would say to you, sorry?
The commentary can't be in English.
Commentary, if you have just Mikra Gedolah in Hebrew only, then that will be accepted. I will be happy with you. Pesukim can be translated into English. I have no problem with that. Okay.
Would the question be about the
Not in name. In other words, the question is more about the what the subject is about, and you will bring in the various ideas. This is an exam to test your sort of awareness of the ideas which have been conveyed through learning this part of Sefer Shmuel. Right? I'm not here to test you on language skills. That, for many of you, I think, was done in high school, if not in elementary school, and I don't want to bring back that particular, for many, nightmare all over again, because it's not what Tanakh is learning is all about. Right? Tanakh learning, to me, is about learning about the people, the real life situations that they had to get through, and what we can learn from them, you know, warts and all, as they say. Some of their positives, some of their negatives. Real life situations, so important for us. Am Yisrael has a treasure called the Tanakh, and it's so precious. And how many Jews know it, right? A lot of non-Jews know it. They know it better than we do. And that's always been my sort of my clarion call: get people to learn Bible, please. I'm on the A train every so often. I see two people sitting next to each other: a young lady coming from Washington Heights, going to Stone College, who's reading Tehillim in Hebrew, and sitting next to a woman who is probably going to do some sort of job in Manhattan, reading Psalms in Spanish. They're probably reading the same Psalm. How amazing. And they don't even realize, they're sitting next to each other, that they are reading the same inspirational words of King David. It's phenomenal. And the only thing I would say is it's probable that the Spanish lady knows the Tehillim better than we do. And I'm sorry about that, because I think we need to know it. And if we don't, we need to work at it. It's one of those things we need to know. But that's my little pitch. Not going to say any more. Alright, any questions about exam, style, technique, anything that we've said? Yeah.
Wait, so it is okay if we bring in like Pasukim that we highlight?
Hmm. Absolutely.
As long but as it's just with English translation, but no commentary.
No commentary, yeah. I mean, okay. if you know by heart some sort of commentary, then mention it, of course. But that's not necessarily what is expected.
What would we get points off if we don't like
put
like specific quotes?
No. It would only, what I would say to you is if you bring in those points, it will enhance your grade, okay. But it won't get points off for not bringing it. Okay. I have expectation of zero, and therefore make my expectation wrong by mini quote, whatever it may be, right? Gam Sha'ul Banavim, the incredible event that happened to Sha'ul, something like that. Alright, if that is clear and present and correct and all the rest of it, we will move on to point number one, the background of Shmuel's birth. This is the most wonderful time. I hope that you all sort of appreciated what we did, that we spent really quite a long time on the first chapter of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, trying to understand Shmuel's background, right? Everybody comes out of seminary and high school and even Hebrew school, wherever you went, and has heard, I hope, along the way, of Chana, amazing mother of Shmuel. And she is amazing. She's one of the great tzaddikistas of the world, okay, of Jewish history. But what we are very unaware of, at least many of us, is the fact that the father was also incredibly, incredibly holy and inspirational. A guy called Elkanah. Elkanah was someone who saw that the Mishkan was in disrepair. Not disrepair in the sense that it needed painting. Disrepair in the sense that people weren't going there. Right? There was just a problem that the Mishkan was not being visited by the Jewish people. They were not doing what they were supposed to do, which is to get to Aliyah Leregel, to go to Yerushalayim. Well, not Yerushalayim. In this case, Shiloh was the main area they had to go to. And they weren't going. So Elkanah, in his infinite wisdom, and with tremendous sense of purpose, made an attempt to bring people to the Mishkan, and the effort was made by sending people around. He took his family, he took a whole entourage, and they went from place to place. So says the first year they went, they took 10 people with them extra. Then it became 20, then it became 50, then it became 100, and eventually it became thousands of people.
And they just kept bringing people.
Kept bringing people. Remarkable. So he understood that the Mishkan needed some sort of encouragement. People needed encouragement to go to the Mishkan, and he did it, to his credit. Remarkable man.
You were like knocking on the door, right?
Yep, you would just go in, and then we saw a whole thing right at the beginning. You've got the handout, which brings the Midrashic text about that. What we are challenged with is something to do with Elkanah's private life, right? Which we're not completely unaware of. And we find that he had two wives. One, Hannah, who was barren, had no children. And Penina, who had many children. And of course, the question that we asked was, number one, was Elkanah sort of sympathetic to Hannah's situation? And we found that he makes some comments which you can interpret whatever you want, but I felt that it was very challenging as to what he actually said to her. Aren't I better for you than 10 children? Right, than 10 sons? You see, Penina has 10 sons, and you have no children. She was doubling for nearly 20 years for a child. And Elkanah says to her, but I'm better than 10 sons. You got me, Bubala, you got me. And of course, not really what she wants to hear. Okay, not a good answer. So that again becomes very challenging. So even with the greatness of the individual when it comes to his ability to inspire the Jewish people, there are still questions about his personal life, his personal situation. We saw the co-wives were very conflicted, right? Penina tries to encourage Hannah to daven, but she does it in a way which is described by various commentaries that we read as Avera Lishma. I spoke about this in my last lesson as well. This is where a sin was being performed, and although it was performed for the sake of God, for the sake of the Jewish people, to encourage Hannah to daven, because it was clearly seen that Hannah would produce, Hannah and Elkanah would produce an amazing child, right, if they were blessed with children, the reality was that the way that Penina encouraged Hannah to daven was done in what looks like a very cruel way. She would hold up the onesie, or a twosie, if there was such a thing, and say that I went shopping today in Babies R Us, where did you go shopping today? And of course, Hannah would start crying, because there's no reason she would go to such a store, or the biblical equivalent, because she had no children. So it was really difficult. So what I'm suggesting is that there is this idea that although Penina did something which clearly was Avera, right, she was definitely giving Hannah a lot of grief. She claimed that it was Lishma. It was done for the purpose, eventually you can argue, as Avera Lishma is always explained, for the purpose of the Jewish people, going to produce a Shmuel. But at the same time, it did also produce a lot of tension, a lot of sadness, and a lot of pressure. And it comes to the point where Hannah is pushed into a situation where she davens so intensely. That's the story with Eli, that he sees her davening, he thinks that she's drunk, and of course what it turns out is that she is davening with such kavanah. She becomes the paradigm of tefillah. We base our behavior in the way that we daven on the way that Hannah davened. Quite remarkable. You would think it would be one of the great rabbis who teaches us how to daven. Turns out, none other than Hannah. She becomes the paradigm of tefillah. Well, she 20 years were, right? It wasn't just one off, it was 20 years. So I think that's always an argument which is never heard when you get into the what I call the feminist debate. Okay, women are not sort of given the prominence that they deserve in the Jewish world, and a lot of non-Orthodox ladies are very vocal about this. And my answer, particularly with people like Hannah and with people like Devora, is just go and learn the tradition. Learn about Hannah. Learn about what she really represented. Learn about Devora, her tzniut, but not tzniut in the length of her skirt. That's nothing to do with it. Devora tzniut in the way that she conducted herself as leader of the Jewish people. Remarkable lady. Remarkable. Very tzniut.
So
she becomes the role model, and that's the idea of Avera Lishma. Other examples of Avera Lishma, something I spoke about in my last lesson, people like Shaul committed Avera Lishma, the witch of Endor, chapter 28 of Shmuel Aleph, and also Esther with Ahasuerus, another example, that she stays with Ahasuerus at the end of the book of Esther, even though she's married to Mordechai, so how can she stay with the non-Jewish king? And again, Avera Lishma becomes Lishma because out of their connection comes Dariovish, who allows the Jews to build the second temple. He gives them permission to continue the building project. So again, these are all things which Avera Lishma is allowed only when it is Leman Ha'am Va'aretz, it's for the sake of the Jewish people, for Eretz Yisrael, etc. And it becomes a very extreme allowance, not allowed in most cases. Yeah.
But it's not like Penina knew that Han was going to give birth to Shmuel. Like,
it doesn't matter. It was going to give birth to someone, whoever he or she may be.
And that, therefore, that God was going to save the Jewish people?
Or? Well, again, who knows what was going to come out of this. There was definite sense that with Elkanah's track record of what he'd done for Am Yisrael, these were not regular parents. These were going to be very unique people who would imbue a child with values which would not be regular values.
So right?
He'd
like
be groomed for greatness, like a prince of a royal family.
She
right?
Would He's, want,
yes, yeah.
So she would want Hannah to like Dominic to have a kid so that like for the sake of the Jewish people said so they would that the generation would keep growing?
And the generation not only would keep growing, but more to the point they would be able to transition, right? And this is what we spoke about in the last lesson, from the period of judges, which was particularly difficult, to the period of kings. The son of Hannah and Elkanah becomes the bridge. He is the bridge between Am Yisrael before having a king and Am Yisrael after they have their first and whatever number of kings after that.
So, right? So that like maybe like their son would be like the next king.
Really important. And it's one of those things that we need to think about. Alright, we need to move on. Number two, the episode of Psak Halacha. What happened with the sacrifice? Shmuel comes with his mother to the Beit HaMikdash. He's a little kid. And there is a line, right? Kohanim out to lunch. Gone to, what's it used to be called? Mendes. What do they call it today? Something on the park. That restaurant across the road. Used to be Mendes. But I don't know if it's still, it may still be Mendes. Something on park. But it's got a new, the restaurant they gave a different name. Something. Whatever. Eden Walk. Or whatever. One of these great places. Paprika, what's that place called?
Paprika.
Okay. Whatever, there's such a lot of places. My daughter was here 20 years ago. When I tell her how many restaurants there are now, in those days, there was literally only one place, Mendes, that was it. Now you've got like half a dozen places within a stone's throw of Brookdale. It's really remarkable. Not to be taken for granted, I assure you. So, what happens is, remember the story, that Shmuel speaks up and says, Rabotai, we don't need a Kohen. They're out to lunch. They're gone. You know what? We can do our avoda. We can slaughter the animal. At least get the process started by employing a shofet. It doesn't have to be a priest. It can even be a regular commoner gardener Jew. And there's a gewalt. There's a tumult. There's a tremendous upheaval because of Shmuel. And who gets to hear about it? Eli. And Eli calls the young man in, and remember that's verse 25. So please look at verse 25 when you review of chapter 1. And verse 25 talks about the connection between the slaughtering of the animal and bringing Shmuel to Eli. So everybody asks, what has one thing got to do with the other? Right? The animal being slaughtered and Shmuel going to Eli doesn't seem to be connected. But according to this Midrashic story brought in Talmud, it is very connected. Because what is happening is that Shmuel is essentially arguing with the hierarchy. He is making a point here, even though he's very young, which is challenging the authority of Eli, and he's very young to understand what Eli's trying to do, and we have a whole analysis that we went through, Eli's point of view, and Shmuel's point of view, and in the end, Chana's point of view. Why did Chana defend Shmuel in the end? Because she said to Eli, you, Eli, promised me that even though Shmuel deserves to be punished for what he did, he's a little kid, and you want to punish him, and you said that I'll have another child, I'm sorry, says Chana, this is not what I davened for originally, I davened for a child, Shmuel is very special, I don't want to see him punished. And in the end, that's exactly what happened, that Shmuel was not punished. Alright? But of course, in the consequence, or in the process of that whole story, we get a very interesting insight into the dynamics of the priesthood. The priesthood in those days was pretty corrupt. Okay? It says that they would keep the women waiting overnight, but according to the Pasuk, Vayishkavu, it says that they slept with the women who brought the sacrifices. That was the literal interpretation. And Rashi says, Kamashma'o, it can even be understood literally. And this is a priest that you don't really want to have any connection with. Certainly women would not readily go. And how contrast it was to what Elkanah was trying to do, to get people to go to the Mishkan. And they got there, and what happened? The women would bring korbanot after they had babies, sort of 2 or 3 months down the line, and they would be treated in the most despicable way, either by being made to wait overnight, not being allowed to go home, which was also unacceptable, or in the worst case scenario, being taken advantage of by the Kohanim. And that, of course, is unacceptable. This is not a happy situation.
But
yeah.
It wasn't saying that Eli did that, it was saying that his
son. And there is this constant tension between the father and the sons. Eli with his sons, and in the end, Shmuel with his sons as well. Okay? And this is all leading us to the sort of conclusion in the end that we need to go to a new form of leader. We need to go to a form of leader where the father and son relationship is different. That is the dynastic concept, which is obviously David followed by Shlomo and beyond. Alright, that's going to work out differently to what we've got here, and certainly not going to produce corruption, not at the beginning. Unfortunately it goes bad later on, but at the beginning it stays pretty solid. Not with Eli, and not even with Shmuel. And how sad that is. Yeah.
Okay, but could we say that like the priesthood was corrupted with the fact that yes, Eli sleep with women, but also in here like Eli was so quick to kill Shmuel?
Correct. And Eli's behavior also gave us a lot of concern. And all we could really come up with was the concept, I think we said, Reb Levi says this, that Eli was trying in his own way to keep his sons connected to the Mishkan. So he was prepared to put up with all of their shtuyot, even though their shtuyot was not very pleasant, what their behavior or their misbehavior was not really acceptable, but he was keeping them engaged with holy work. Because obviously what they were interested in is their Swiss bank accounts, or the equivalent in those days. They were making a lot of money out of the whole thing. They took food by force, right? All of that whole discussion, and remember we even elaborated on the discussion to suggest that there's a pasuk which talks about that Hashem wanted to kill them, so they behaved in the way they did. God took away their free choice. And the Radak says that the sons of Eli were really no better than Parah. And that became a very big discussion that we had, trying to understand what it means that when they had no free choice, that Hashem hardened their heart, doesn't mean that they had no free choice. It meant that they unfortunately saw things in a very logical way, but not in a very kosher way. So their logic dictated they do what they do. As with Paro, his logic said, chase after the Jews or keep the Jews slaves. Not very good. And the same with the sons of Eli. The logic was, we deserve these gifts. And of course, that became the thing that worked against them, the serious problem that we had with the sons of Eli, which eventually causes their demise. They go to battle and they are killed. And as a result, Eli is killed. Yeah.
Who was the modern day rabbi? That
yeah, we had somebody called Rabbi. We spoke about a rabbi from Israel called Yehuda Eisenberg.
Okay.
And you have a piece from him. Somebody that I had the pleasure of listening to some of his shiurim a long time ago, 20 years ago in Israel, but really very, very good teacher in Bar Ilan. So he tried to give a little bit of analysis of that whole very, very difficult part of chapter 2. Number 3, the calling of Shmuel. Yes, very quickly.
Wait, so why did he still put up with his sons if they were asking to
keep them engaged, keep them connected.
So they weren't like straight from the Torah?
Correct. And it's interesting, and I didn't say this in class, but I'm going to say it now, that I have a very good friend in Israel, it's just one example, who has 4 children, 2 of whom are religious, and 2 of whom are not religious. And to his credit, to his wife's credit, they keep contact with the whole family. They come for Shabbatot, the religious and the non-religious. The non-religious will probably go home in the middle of Shabbos. And, you know, you accept that as a reality, but they do come and they are connected to the parents who are exhibiting, showing their religious lifestyle. So the reality is, it's very often about kesher, keeping that contact. Right? There's no guarantees in life that your kids will turn out to be observant, but if you keep the contact, you just never ever know down the line what can happen. Right? They may stray a little bit at the beginning and they may become very connected later on. Who knows? Right? Your job as a parent is to keep that channel of connection alive. I really believe that. And I've seen it again and again. And I've also seen the cases, the extreme reaction when parents say, I don't want to have anything more to do with my children, usually in the Hasidic world, and that is a disaster. There are now thousands of ex-Hasidic Jews running around New York who have left Hasidic lifestyle and have become not just secular, but totally, totally irreligious, to the point where they do nothing of any Jewishness whatsoever. They have organizations, Footsteps, a very big organization. And it's sad. It's sad because all of it seems to have begun with some negative home experiences, which led to a disconnect with their families, and the families are not able to cope with this, right? And it's really sad, sad comment, unfortunately, on some of the social issues in the Hasidic world. Hasidic Jewry is a phenomenon. Came here in 1945. There may have been a few hundred Hasidic survivors of the Holocaust. Today, you're looking at thousands, hundreds of thousands of Hasidic Jews in America. Phenomenal. But they now have to get a bit more into the 21st century and sort of deal with a lot of the social issues, which are extremely, extremely challenging. Right? Not saying that they're not dealing with it, but it's hard. It's hard when you have a very rigid view on life and you have to be a bit less rigid, a bit more flexible. That's what I'm going to say, but I think it's an important point. So when it comes to what we're learning here, the whole story of Eli with his sons, I think it gives us sort of, again, a bit of an insight. He kept contact. He kept connecting. Even Shmuel as well. His sons were also very monetarily motivated. But Shmuel never lost contact with them. Right? We don't hear about them very much after Shmuel dies, because they just were not good people. They were, unfortunately, what we would nowadays call very much greed. You know, greed coloured their lives. And that's a sad situation. But Shmuel, to his credit, kept contact. And that's something which I think is important. Alright, let's go on, because we're not going to get through this. Calling of Shmuel. Definition of prophecy. This was a very beautiful analysis at the beginning of chapter 3, where we saw that there's an argument between Rambam, with a mem, Maimonides, and Abarbanel. Rambam says that prophecy is always in a trance. It's always by indirect means. Right? It can be a dream, can be some sort of hallucination, whatever it may be. Whereas, says the Abarbanel, no. Story of Shmuel, and there's a whole analysis of Sukkim. The story of Shmuel proves that Shmuel was hearing a voice. It wasn't in a dream. He wasn't half asleep. He was hearing a direct calling, and it was God calling to him. So, Barbanel says from the story of Shmuel, it's clear that prophecy, in the days of prophecy, was a direct voice from Hashem. Wasn't a, wasn't an imaginary, illusionary experience. Right? And Rambam says it was. Rambam disagrees. And there's a whole discussion between Barbanel and Rambam in terms of how to explain the story. Yeah.
So you could also put inside
with
like Joseph, like his was a dream.
Yeah. Correct. And again, there's also with Avraham Avinu, Rambam says the three angels were in fact a dream. Right? Says that in Moreh Nevuchim. He says that it wasn't really an event that took place, but it was a dream, which was eventually sending him a message that, you know, they were going to have a baby, even though he was 100 years old. Okay? Pretty... unbelievable story. The Bobby becomes a mummy. How scary is that? I told my wife that once, that, you know, how would you feel if you were Sarah? And without too many words, she told me that she would probably emigrate, I think is the word that she used, or words to that effect. She just couldn't handle it. Most women, you get to a certain age, that's it, you're done. So how Sarah became so, sort of able to deal with that circumstance is quite extraordinary. And it says, according to Chazal, she even had no womb. She was even to the point where the baby was a total miracle child. Okay? Quite amazing, the whole story of the birth of Yitzchak. Which again is certainly worth looking at in more detail on another occasion. So that's the calling of Shmuel. Very famous, called three times. Hineni, here I am. Shmuel, Shmuel, etc., etc. Rambam and Abarbanel. Alright, number 4.
And Avram also had like Hashem called out to him.
Sorry, again?
And Avram had that too.
And Avram had the same thing, yeah, absolutely. Number 4, the lessons of the capture and return of the Aron, chapters 4 through 7. Okay, just the whole run around with the Aron, where it went, how it was captured, the whole disaster that people did not treat the Aron with the respect that it deserved. We had a whole discussion, was it one Aron only, or maybe this was a special Aron taken to war? But clearly the Jewish people saw it as a weapon of, let's use the term, the modern day term, mass destruction, and it really wasn't. What the Aron reflected was the spiritual values of the people. If they were holy, the Aron would help them. If they weren't holy, the Aron was a wooden box covered with gold, and that was it. Nothing more, nothing less. So the reality of the Aron was that it was relied upon when it shouldn't have been. eventually, after the travels of the Aron and the whole story of where he went, comes back to Eretz Yisrael, never goes back to the Mishkan, eventually goes straight to Yerushalayim. The Aron becomes the first holy object to come into Jerusalem, Shmuel Bet, chapter 5 or chapter 6 over there. And the reality is that the Aron represents really the problem of the generation that Shmuel was coming to fix by having a melech that they would, you know, sort of fall back on certain situations. They would fall back on certain assumptions which were totally wrong. Their assumption was if they've got the Aron, everything will be fine, and it was a totally false assumption. It's about their ability to to grow in spiritual terms, ability to be closer to Hashem. And that's the whole story. And that's really what it boils down to the 21st century. I honestly believe, with sort of the whole of Avi, that Israel today is blossoming for a number of reasons. And one of them is that, as controversial as it is that so many people are learning Torah full time, and maybe a lot of them could probably be better occupied doing other things, the reality of it is that full-time Torah study in Israel is a tremendous merit, not only for the people doing it, but for the people supporting it. Who is the biggest supporter of Torah study in Israel today? The Israeli government. And don't let anybody tell you otherwise, they support Torah study. And the reality is, that's a tremendous zechut. Why is the government successful? Why is the country so successful? I believe there is a spiritual dimension today which we haven't seen for literally 2,000 years, and that is the dimension of the power of Torah study. Quite extraordinary, right? And again, as I said, maybe we've come to the point where next generation has to be more practical. We can't support the number of people in Kollel and study, but nevertheless, it's a zechut, it's a merit for Am Yisrael, tremendous merit, and for the Israeli government. I've got to say, and people don't recognize that. People put down the Israeli government, and it's wrong. Okay, it's not a religious government, but boy, do they give a lot of money to people to study in Kollel and Yeshiva. Quite extraordinary. Alright, that's a little bit of politics. I always like to throw in a little curveball here on there. Not too much of a curveball. Number 5, the issues surrounding the appointment of a king. Good or bad? Let's have a vote, or let's have a reaction. Appointing the king, good thing or bad thing? Says the Pasuk, Shmuel says to the people, Sarah, he says to them, good or bad? 50% chance of getting it right. It was... Sorry? It was at the wrong time. So essentially it was bad. Right? It would have been good if it had been at the right time. Perfect. If it was at the wrong time, it was premature, the request, for lots of other reasons, and we went into all of the history of having kings, etc. It was a mitzvah which was conditional. Right? Don't forget that. The mitzvah was emor lahem, that they would have to ask for the king. It's not a mitzvah that they have to do immediately coming into Eretz Israel. They have to get to a point where they need a king. And now they were at that particular point, and that's where the request was made. But as we saw, not quite at the right time. What is the suggestion of the run? Very interesting suggestion. That the king might have l'shofteinu k'chol ha-goyim. Remember that phrase? That he's going to judge us. But what's k'chol ha-goyim? Either that the king would be like all the other kings around, and we would have a king, would be our judge, or the Shofteinu, he would judge us k'chol ha-goyim, according to the laws of the non-Jews. He may introduce secular law. And of course, that would be very bad. For the king of Israel to judge everybody according to his rules, without following the rules of Torah, is something that was an ever-present danger. And as a consequence, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the famous commentaries, says that was the problem, why the initial request was seemed to be bad, but nevertheless, Sarah, it was good. Alright? Why was it good? Because it was listened to. It got a king. Okay? So that's what I think is important. To discuss both sides of the equation. Okay? Are you clear? You look a bit mystified. You good? Yeah? You're not bad. You're good. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Sorry, yeah. Correct. There was this concept that in the end of the day, they still had Hashem who was there for them, as they say nowadays, batting in your corner. Or do you say such a thing? I'm not quite sure whether you do. Fighting in your corner. And you also had Shmuel HaNavi. And Shmuel HaNavi was still around. He was able to do his thing, like he proves with the miracle of the rain. right? Which is again a whole chapter, which is important to know. Okay, so all of that was a sign that maybe asking for a king at this point in time had not only dangers of going off the rails, Am Yisrael might have sort of taken it in the wrong direction, and also at the same time being a premature, or as you would say, premature request. Okay, so I hope that's understood. Yes.
So you're saying that, like, based, like, off the timing, that, like, if the king came and he promoted Jewish laws, and that's one thing, but if he promoted, like, non-Jewish laws, that's another thing. And
correct.
But then you said that at the end that it was a good thing.
It was. In the end, it was a good thing. Hashem says, do it. Right? It became good because Hashem said, you know, the people have asked for it. That was the caveat in the Torah. Right? That was the condition, that if the people come and ask for it, we have to provide them with the goods, as they say, with the person. And Hashem says, although this is a rejection of Shmuel, in a way, a rejection of a God, but it is still something which Hashem takes as a, in the end, a positive request, and provides an amazing leader called Shaul HaMelech. Alright, so again, that whole discussion of the appointment of a king is really, really important.
But they didn't get it right away when they came to Israel.
And it took time for the penny to drop. Number six, Shaul, from the wrong tribe. So what are we going to say? What's the bottom line? Right? He was the tribe of Binyamin. Kings were meant to come from the tribe of... not Binyamin, but... David comes from the tribe of... Yehuda. Good. So why was the first king an exception to the rule? And the answer is, says the Barbanel, we went through a whole piece, because he was the right person at the right time. There are others who later on would be more outstanding from other tribes. But at that moment, he's the real deal. He is the person to follow more than anybody else. That's Shaul HaMelech. And boy, what an outstanding person. What did it say about him physically? What was the description? Always think of my shampoo. Right? What's my shampoo called? Head and Shoulders, right? This is a wonderful shampoo. Always reminds me of Shaul. Okay? Still available to this very day, I'm pretty sure. I was very excited because we had it in England. I came to America. There it is. Wonderful. Really thrilled. That shouldn't be on the tape, but why not? A little bit of digression. Head and Shoulders. That was Shaul above everybody else. Physically and also, at that point, spiritually. A dynamo. A man who had the potential for tremendous greatness. Yes, have you gone? No, we're saying he was the right person at that time, because he was, as his name suggests, Shaul Boro. Shaul literally means in Hebrew to borrow. That means something, you borrow something, eventually, hopefully, you give it back. So it's a temporary situation. And his name, as we said, makes an allusion to the fact that he was temporary, wasn't meant to be permanent. But of course, he didn't know that, or he may have had an inkling, but he did his best, whatever the situation was. Okay? And even though he lost the kingship, as we saw last time, in such a sad way, the reality of it is that Shaul was and remains one of the great heroes of the Jewish people.
So right? He was never supposed to be long, but then there was always a plan that he was going to be...
Yeah, but not to lose the kingship the way he did. Okay?
So
there was a plan. His son would take over. Yonatan would be the next king. Look at Yonatan. What a character. Right? If we get excited about David as king, what Yonatan would have been like as king is... potentially, who knows, would have been so incredible. Because Yonatan was a big tzaddik.
Aren't all kingships going to end up?
Not necessarily. That's where free will comes in. Free choice. I want to get through this. So let's see. So we're saying that he was not from the wrong tribe in the sense that he was the right person at that particular time. The farewell speech, chapter 12. Right, what was so incredible about it, and please look at our notes because this is really important. Right, there is a question on chapter 12 I want to tell you, and it's something that you need to revise. The whole question of Shmuel making a miracle of the rain. Right, he says to the Jewish people, I'm on the verge of leaving you. I'm about to die. He knew that his imminent demise was about to happen. And nevertheless, he says, before I die, I have to give you some chizuk. And the chizuk is that as long as you follow God, as long as you follow the commandments, as long as you stick to the script, everything will be fine. Okay? That is the message of Shmuel. And he says to the people, I'll prove to you either that when you chose a king, as Rashi says, it was wrong at the time because you were rejecting me, and I'll snap my fingers, it will rain. If I can make it rain in the summer in Israel, that's a good sign that I still have the ability, right, to lead you and to make things happen. And it rained. Right? As I said, it never rains in Israel except this one occasion when it rained in the middle of July or whenever it was, and it was a bombshell. Okay? The other explanation, which I like very much, is the Abarbanel, who says that the rain episode proves that Hashem, in the end of the day, gives credence to the choices of man. Man chooses and God allows those choices to go through, whether they're good or whether they're not so good. Alright? And that's the basis of what we call free will. And I explained that that is a very, very fundamental point in Jewish philosophy, because in Jewish philosophy there is a very strong school of thought that when man behaves in an evil way, right, it's not, as it were, the expectation should not be that God will intervene. God never intervenes, because Hashem allows man to choose to do good and to do bad. That is the fundamental way that the world runs, according to the free will of the human being. What I do say, what a lot of people, when they talk about Holocaust, for instance, will say, is that what is so disgusting was the fact that so many millions of people of a so-called cultured society chose, I stress, to be so evil. They claim that they were influenced by propaganda, they were influenced by this. At the end of the day, if you take a gun and kill an innocent person, a child, you kill an old man, whatever they did, and they did this by the hundreds of thousands of millions, that is a choice which was evil. And you deserve to be punished for doing that. And no excuse. Right? It's the evil of man which we have to cope with, not the fact that Hashem did not stop it. I've never had a problem with God in terms of Holocaust theology, but I have a massive problem trying to understand the human mind doing these terrible things. How did they make themselves do these evil things without, and then going to sleep at night, right? Or playing Mozart, you know, after shooting 100 people that would go and listen to a piano recital. Blows the mind. These are sick, sick people. They must have been. Have you gone?
Okay, can you say that,
it's one of the issues of Shmuel Aleph, which you can elaborate on. Yeah,
okay,
absolutely. That's an overall message of one of the messages of the book, right? Which is very clear from the, as the Abarbanel says in chapter 12, and that's a fabulous chapter. Shmuel's drosha is phenomenal. We're nearly there. I'm looking at the time, and we're almost done. Number 8, Yonatan's behavior, chapter 14, Chush. Remember, we did a whole analysis of it. Were you allowed to make those signs? So what was the allowance? Anybody? Remind me what we said, the consensus that it's, when is it hocus pocus? When it is, God bless you, when it is done not according to the laws of, what word am I looking for? In Hebrew, svara, in English, logic. If it's logical, it makes sense, then it's not nichush. It's something that makes sense. What Yonatan did and what Eliezer ben Avraham did was logical. He may have been looking for a sign, but it was based on a logical expectation. In the case of Yonatan, that if they come out of the camp, they are strong, and if they let me into the camp, they are weak. And they did. They let him into the camp, and next thing you know, the Philistines are running all over the place. They're being beaten, even though Shaul's army was so small. Okay, so that was one of the great insights into the whole question of Nichush. We said other possibilities that Yonatan did what he did because he was trying to give some strength to his armor bearer. Remember that we said that he's trying to give him a bit of encouragement? Different points of view. You don't have to say who said it, but just the ideas. Alright, or we said also, you know, at the end of the day, what Yonatan did, according to Rambam, was in fact wrong. But according to everybody else, and really we need to explain Rambam's opinion, but according to everybody else, turns out, and even the Rambam would seem to say that under normal circumstances it would be wrong, but if we learn like the other opinion of logic, then even the Rambam would agree, Nichush based on logic might very well be allowed. And the only question that we had was the opinion of someone called the Ravad, the commentary on the Rambam, who says the Rambam is absolutely unacceptable when he criticizes Yonatan. He says, how can the Rambam say such a tzaddik did something against the Torah? And the answer is, maybe the Rambam never said it in that way. Alright, so if you look at your notes, what we saw on that. Any comments, any questions? I'm just belting through this at the moment. But I'm trying to sort of stir up a little bit of those memory cells that hopefully are still alive, even though we're melting so quickly in this room. I've melted already. Number 9. Sha'ul's behavior in Amalek, why he lost the kingship and David did not. So we explain that Sha'ul was either behaving in... when he was commanded to do something as a king and he behaved very badly, right? And that was a critique because as a king he was expected to behave in the way of a king. David never was called out by doing things which he did being commanded as a king to do. These were private things, right? Either counting Jewish people, which is a command on every Jew, or the whole thing with Bathsheba, which again was a personal situation. So when David is called out on both of them and he says Chatati, that becomes a merit for David. Sha'ul, on his behavior when it comes to the people of Israel and the fact that he doesn't kill Amalek the way he's supposed to, that becomes for him something negative. Because he doesn't immediately say Chatati, as the commentary says, called the Marsha, which is what we finished with on Tuesday. He says that it's all about the reactions. David reacted immediately to being told he was wrong by saying, I'm wrong. Sha'ul reacted not immediately by saying, I'm wrong. Only when it was pointing out to him that he was wrong did he react and say, I'm wrong. So his timing, Sha'ul's timing, was off. And that became a problem in his whole character. And as a result, says Shmuel on the advice of God, that Sha'ul has lost the kingship. He's going to be the king, but he's not going to continue. The dynasty is going to end with his son Ishbosheth, as you will see in chapter 2, sorry, in chapter, whatever it is, chapter 4, I think it is, of Shmuel Bet. Okay, and that's the end of that story. Yes?
Okay, so first Sha'ul, he tried to justify it when he was confronted about it. And
he had all the excuses. David never... I'm wrong, says David.
And then can you also say that with David, his was more personal or private, while Sha'ul's was more of a public...
Correct. Sha'ul's commandment was much more of a public, kingly... what word are we going to use? It was something which he had to do as part of his job as king of Israel.
Okay, and then also going back to like an idea to share for number 10, for not just also free choice, can you also see that timing?
Yeah, timing is a very serious issue in the whole book, right? That the whole question of things happening at the right time or happening at the wrong time becomes a real challenge. Now you'll say to me, how will we ever know that it's the right time or the wrong time? That's, very often a judgment call. And what is sad about the Sefer Shmuel, in many of the stories, is that they made very bad judgment calls. Right? In certain cases, their judgment calls were correct. David eventually shows us that when you're told you're wrong, then the timing is absolutely to admit your fault without question. Right? And that's, to this very day, a big challenge in leadership. Look how many presidents we've seen that were forced into admitting they did something wrong. With President Clinton, it took him 6 months to admit to what he did. And with the current president, God only knows how long it's going to take him, but who knows. And, you know, they didn't do that. These are not our role models, thank God. They're leaders. They may do great things as leaders, but they're not our role models. Right? At least I hope they're not. If you have role models as presidents of the United States, find another role model, for goodness sake. Yes.
Wait, but how was this with Sha'ul and David bad timing?
Bad timing because in the end, Sha'ul was someone who either the bad timing of becoming the king, when he shouldn't have been the king, that's not his fault, but in reality, and his reaction time to being told that he did something wrong.
It was too late.
Too late.
But what about David? How was that for
David? David always comes up with the word Chatati immediately. Right? He knows the Navi knows better than him. And if the Navi says in the name of Hashem, you've done something wrong, David's immediate reaction is, Chatati, how can I put it right? And that's King David.
Sorry.
He's a tzaddik. Yes.
Did you also say that judgment was a big deal because with Eli, he was quick to judge
Excellent.
Shmuel, and then also with Hashem, the Jewish people, the judgment between the kings.
Correct. And of course, in the end of the day, the way that the people judged Shmuel in terms of rejecting him when he still was able to be the shofet for a bit longer before they needed a king proper. Right? So again, number 10, overall comments, the authorship of the book, clearly till the middle of Shmuel Aleph, it's Shmuel himself. Right? That becomes an issue next semester for those who stay with the program. We're going to finish Shmuel Aleph, and then Shmuel dies in chapter 25, so then the Nevi'im, other prophets, take over. The messages of the book and the ideas of the book, much of which we've discussed today, and I hope that's all become a bit clearer, you become a bit wiser, and hopefully taken the message away. Sefer Shmuel is, without doubt, it's compulsory reading for every serious Jewish man, woman, and child in the 21st century, because the lessons of Sefer Shmuel are phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. Just take Elkanah and the idea of inspirational leadership. You can't get anything better than that. That's why we read it on Rosh Hashanah. The Haftarah, when most Jews are in shul, happens to be the Haftarah of chapter 1 of Sefer Shmuel. We read about Hannah, the importance of prayer, and we read about Elkanah, the importance of being an inspirational Jew. Wow. Can't get bigger than that. Okay, that's why I like in South Africa, what's his name, Rabbi Goldstein, chief rabbi of South Africa, he's a very inspirational man. The Shabbat across South Africa, whatever they call it, became Shabbat across London, it's all over the world. Phenomenal. Inspirational. It's great. And there are people who are incredible like that, and to their credit, and we need to recognize that. And to listen to them every so often, whatever, when it comes up. Final comments will be that. Please, obviously, if you have questions, again, to remind you, rebshaff@aol.com. I will see you all the exam. I want to sort of thank everybody. I always, always appreciate the smaller group. Number one, I remember your names. Number two, I remember who you are, right? Get to know you, which I always am very happy about, especially if you come back for two or three semesters. That's something you seem to do. Wonder why. Like the accent, I guess. I don't know what. Whatever it is. But seriously, I am very, very happy to have had this connection, and I look forward to seeing many of you again in your, you know, academic careers as you go through Stern. And for those who are graduating, Sarah and others, good luck. Come and say hello if you're in the neighborhood. Always like to. And if you want to follow on YU Torah, as I said, this shiur will be on YU Torah. Just look up my name, Shafa with an SH, not SCH, and it should come up as the first or second shiur. And if you want to carry on learning with your professor, there are a lot of shiurim there on different Sforim of the Bible. And, you know, set yourself every so often, every week, to learn one perek a week. You get through amazing amount of Tanakh in a short period of time. And you've got a lot of help in that particular web page, either what I'm doing or a lot of other rabbis. You know, don't hesitate. It's really exciting. There's a lot of good learning opportunities. I would say to you, good luck in the exams, and look forward to seeing everybody. Any final questions? Right, as I always end my course, Mikom Alumni Sculpty, I really learned a lot from you guys. Your essays were phenomenal. I don't think I've given so many A's in my life, okay? Which is always a good thing. And I'm very excited about that. And Bezrat Hashem, I'm sure you're all going to do very well. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. All right, see you all 2 weeks, approximately. Shabbat Shalom. Take care, everybody.